College, I work as a utilities assistant this year. Before moving to Holden, I worked as a lobbyist in Washington, D.C. for an organization called the American Association for Palestinian Equal Rights. I'm going to talk a little bit tonight about U.S. foreign policy for the Middle East, in particular the relationship between the United States and Israel, because that's the big one shaping our overall foreign policy toward the region. I gave a presentation Monday night about work I did before moving to D.C. in the occupied Palestinian territories, an organization called the Christian Peacemaker Teams. Our work there was to support the nonviolent resistance movement in Palestine. And I said this on Monday, but the reason I went to D.C. after that was because everywhere I went in Palestine, I was told over and over and over again, we appreciate the work that you're doing, but you're an American citizen. Don't you realize that if you went home and changed your government, we wouldn't need you to come back here and do this kind of work? There was one of the elder women in the village that I worked in called Atwani. Her name was Umjuma, and she said the same thing every single time I left the village. Goodbye, we'll see you soon. God willing, it will be as a guest and not as a worker. And so I went to DC, and I learned a lot. I also earned my master's degree during that time. From the American University, I studied philosophical ethics, peace studies, and global affairs there, which was a great and fascinating program and gave me the opportunity to study some of this. I'm going to begin tonight by showing a clip from a movie called Occupation 101. I don't know if you've heard of this. It's an excellent documentary film made in 2006, so some of it's a little bit dated, but I think it really still stands up. 5 years later, it was an award-winning film for that year. It gives a great overview of what's happening in Palestine, how we got to where we are, where we might move. And so this is a clip that talks a bit about the role of the United States in upholding the conflict. It's only about 3 minutes long, but I'm going to go ahead and turn off the light so you can see a little bit better, and we'll get started. So I saw this for the first time in 2006. I've been working on this issue for about 5 years at that point. And that shocked me. I think just the way it's presented with the graphics, there were numbers I had heard before, but I think it's a really effective way of presenting that kind of information. The presentation I gave on Monday was a little bit more, it was a PowerPoint, there were slides, there were pictures. Tonight's going to be a little bit more extemporaneous. I'm going to talk a lot. And hopefully I wrote down some bullet points to keep me on track, but hopefully I can keep my comments to within half an hour, 40 minutes or so, and then we can discuss the things that are most interesting to you. We're going to back up a little bit and talk about the early foreign relations, U.S. foreign relations toward Israel, and then move on to discussing the special relationship between Israel and the United States. And that terminology is the official terminology that they use in Washington, the special relationship. If you say that out of context in general, people in Washington know you're talking about Israel. And then we can't talk about the special relationship without talking about the Israel lobby. So we'll talk a lot about that tonight as well. We'll touch on the results of the U.S. Foreign policy toward Israel and toward the Middle East, results for the people of Palestine, and results for us here in the United States, because it has major implications for our own national security and our own well-being as a country. And then we'll look at what now? Where are we going to go from here? What efforts are underway to try to move us forward in a different, healthier direction? What efforts are underway to ensure that we stay exactly where we are? So, moving backward in time a little bit. During the 19th century and the first half of the 20th century, the United States was not particularly supportive of Zionist aspirations for the establishment of a Jewish state in the Middle East. It wasn't something that I would say we were actively fighting, but it certainly wasn't a priority for us to see the establishment of a Jewish state halfway around the world from us. This was more of an isolationist time in U.S. history, and we were more focused on what was happening at home. The Holocaust changed that. It galvanized a lot of emotional support here for the Jewish people, and it really made the case that the Jewish people were not going to be safe living as a diaspora community in Eastern Europe. And so in 1947, President Truman signed UN Resolution 181, which is also known as the UN Partition Plan. This divided Palestine into two states, a Palestinian Arab state and an Israeli Jewish state. But in the beginning, though we signed on to this, we offered our support for the establishment of the state, we still weren't particularly supportive of Israel. I think our position in the region could best be described as neutral. From the beginning, Israel was a recipient of U.S. foreign aid, but just like any other state that was receiving money from the United States, that aid was conditional. If Israel was using that aid in ways that were counter to U.S. interests, we would cut that aid. An example of this came in 1956. Israel was at war with Egypt in the Suez War. It came away from that war in control of the Egyptian Sinai Peninsula and the Palestinian Gaza Strip. Israeli Prime Minister at the time, David Ben-Gurion, immediately said he was going to hold on to those lands. He would not give them back. The international community disagreed with him. The United Nations demanded that he return those lands. And it was President Eisenhower in the United States who went to Congress and said, okay, if Israel does not return the lands that it conquered in this war, we need to cut funding. So he went to Congress, he asked for this, Congress said, of course, and they cut aid to Israel. In 1957, Ben-Gurion abandoned the lands that were conquered during that war and returned to Israel's borders. The United States was not the only state that pulled funding at that time. We weren't quite as influential as we are there right now. But it's an example of something that I think we would never see happen anymore in this day and age. The last president to attempt to condition Israeli aid was President George H.W. Bush, and he was doing this in response to Israeli settlement expansion. Settlement expansion, the existence of Israeli settlements is contrary to U.S. foreign policy, or to U.S. policy, and so Bush went to Congress, asked Congress to suspend aid to Israel until it stopped the settlement program. Congress said absolutely not. And this is one of the major reasons cited as to why Bush lost the re-election a couple of years later. In 1963, President Kennedy was in office when we brokered the first major arms deal between the United States and Israel. And looking back through some of these documents, there are three main reasons Kennedy decided to go this route. The first was a simple domestic political calculus. He was trying to secure the Jewish American vote here in this country for his re-election campaign. The second was to stop Israeli nuclear ambitions. This is during the Cold War. Israel is a small new state surrounded by hostile Arab enemies that have already proven willing to go to war with Israel a few times. And so it seemed reasonable that Israel may begin to seek a nuclear weapon for its own self-defense. Kennedy and his advisors thought that if they could assure Israel that Israel had the support of the United States, that we were going to support it financially and with weapons, then maybe it wouldn't feel the need to go that route. Of course, we know now that Israel is a nuclear power, so this didn't work the way we intended. But the third reason that we brokered this arms deal between Israel and the United States is what I think is probably the most important. And it's something that we will continue, it'll be a continuing theme as we discuss things this evening. And that was the goal of countering the Soviet weapons sale to Egypt. Cold War politics. Everywhere the USSR is active, we need to be active. We need to be able to exert our influence in that region. We did not have a foothold in the Middle East at that time. Egypt and the USSR were relatively close, and so by building this relationship with Israel and beginning to arm it with weaponry, we could have our foothold in the Middle East and we could send a message to Moscow that we are relevant in this region as well. This paid off for us in 1967. In 1967, Israel went to war with five of its neighbors, with Jordan, Syria, Iraq, Lebanon, and Egypt, as well as the Palestinians within its own territories. And Israel came away victorious. That sent a message to Moscow. The United States can exert its influence here. The small state that we're backing is the state that comes out on top. It also sent a message to the other Arab states that had not yet aligned with either the USSR or the United States. It sent a message that the United States is the one that can defend its allies. And this began to pay off. This idea that Israel is a vital strategic ally for the United States, that's a phrase I'll use a lot tonight, I think, began to pay off in the early 70s when relations between the Soviet Union and Egypt began to cool, and eventually Egypt did align itself with the United States. This paved the way for the U.S. to broker a peace deal between Egypt and Israel, which holds to this day. Diplomatic support for Israel began to increase in the 1960s and 1970s as well, not just financial and military support. In 1967, at the end of the June War that left Israel in control of the Palestinian territories, once again the international community, headed by the United Nations, told Israel it had to give those lands back. On Monday, we talked a little bit about why Israel felt it could not do that. Israel wanted to hang on to those territories, felt it made it a stronger state, protected its borders a little bit better, and it began the occupation. And so when it came to a vote in the UN Security Council, the United States used its veto power to block the Security Council from compelling Israel to return those lands. That was the first time, 1967, that the United States used its veto power to defend Israeli interests. In the 1970s, the United States began stockpiling weapons in Israel, the idea being if we needed to intervene militarily in the region, our weapons would already be there. Incidentally, when Israel invaded Lebanon in the summer of 2006, we soon found out that they used our weapons. They had not consulted us in advance, and as far as I know, 5 years later, they have not replaced those weapons or paid us back for them. But at the time, the idea was that if we had a friendly ally, someone we could trust with our weapons, that was going to make us stronger again in the Cold War. In 1973, Israel was again at war, this time with Egypt and Syria, and President Nixon was in office in the United States. He backed Israel by increasing the amount of weapons and aid that we were sending to Israel, and his idea at this time was that if Israel could defeat Egypt and Syria, which are the largest and most powerful of the Arab states, then he, Nixon, the United States, could begin to impose a comprehensive peace upon the Middle East that would be completely in line with U.S. interests. Some of you in this room may remember the actual result of this war was an Arab oil embargo that completely crippled the American economy for quite some time. By the 1980s, the special relationship between Israel and the United States was pretty well established. So let's take a look at what this relationship entails. I think we need to begin with the money, just because it is so overwhelming. Occupation 101, the film that we showed at the beginning here, said that Israel was receiving between $2 and $3 billion a year in foreign aid. That was 5 years ago. The figure is now closer to $3.2 billion a year in aid. Besides the sheer amount of the aid, what makes it unique is that it is granted unconditionally. Any other state or non-state entity that receives U.S. foreign aid has to account for how every single penny is spent. The State Department oversees this. And if they suspect that money is being used in ways that are contrary to U.S. interests or to stated U.S. policy, the money will be cut. It's as simple as that. I think that's the way foreign aid should work. Israel doesn't face any of those restrictions. Israel does not report to us on how they spend that money either, but some of the documents that we have been able to get our hands on here have proven that Israel is using at least some of that money to fund the occupation of the Palestinian territories and to expand its settlement project. Settlements, again, being absolutely counter to stated U.S. policy. We also grant aid to other states in the region with Israeli interests in mind. Egypt and Jordan are the second and third highest recipients of U.S. foreign policy, respectively, and they are the two Arab states that have made peace with Israel. This is no coincidence. This is something that is really, really coming into play right now in Egypt. The Egyptian-Israeli relationship is not popular in Egypt. The average Egyptian does not approve of Egypt's complicity in upholding the siege of the Gaza Strip and in working so closely with Jerusalem. When Hosni Mubarak was pushed from power this winter spring, it put the military council, which took over, in a really difficult position. The council understands that the Egyptian people are mobilized right now, and if they feel that their demands are not being met, they're going to return to the streets, and they're going to continue to push for change. However, if Egypt were to break its treaty with Israel, or not even break the treaty, but go against the Israeli wishes and the U.S. wishes, to a certain degree, then Egypt could stand to lose its U.S. foreign aid, which is at $1.5 billion a year right now. So they're walking a really fine line, and I think whatever democratically elected head of state comes to power in Egypt, that's going to be one of the hardest things for them to navigate in all of this. How do you improve your relations with Palestine? How do you make the Egyptian people feel better about what you are doing in the Middle East in regards to Egypt or in regards to Israel and Palestine while hanging on to that money that is coming from the United States? So if Egypt and Jordan are examples of countries that have benefited from your relations with Israel, of course, on the other hand, we have Iran as an example of a country that has not benefited. Iran does not recognize Israel's right to exist. Iran has no diplomatic relations with the United States. There are a number of reasons for our lack of diplomatic relations with Iran, but the one that is stated over and over and over again publicly by presidents and by members of Congress is Iran's refusal to recognize Israel. So all of that is tied into the special relationship, how we are acting throughout the Middle East. Besides the money, we, the United States, and I'm sorry if there are non-U.S. citizens here, I use the word we a lot because we are here in the United States right now. But the U.S. defends Israel in international fora on a regular basis, most prominently in the United Nations. The first time we used the Security Council veto was 1967. We have now used it 57 times. We have used our veto power more than any other country in the Security Council, any other permanent member of the Security Council, I should say. The most recent time that we used our veto power was just this last winter. There was a resolution before the Security Council to declare Israeli settlements illegal. I've said this a few times. U.S. policy is that Israeli settlements are illegal. We should have voted for this resolution, but we used our veto power anyway. And I think that this reveals the deep hypocrisy of the United States in terms of relating to Israel and other states throughout the Middle East. The stated reason for not supporting this resolution, for vetoing it, for blocking it, was that it's simply not helpful. We're trying to restart the negotiations process. To further alienate Israel is not going to encourage Israel to return to the negotiating table. I think that's a pretty weak argument. Israel has been told it needs to stop this over and over again, and it's always given tacit approval to continue its settlement project because the Security Council, the only body in the UN that could take decisive action against Israel, is incapable of acting because of its defense, the defense of Israel by the United States. The Palestinians are going to the United Nations this September to seek statehood. They are putting together a proposal. They're going to go to the General Assembly this time, not the Security Council, because of the U.S. veto, and put forth a proposal for statehood. Chances are this is going to be approved. I think I'll be shocked if it's not approved. But the United States has already stood up and said that we are going to vote no on this resolution. Because again, while we do actually want a Palestinian state, we want a Palestinian state that comes through negotiations, not through unilateral Palestinian declarations of statehood. I'm not sure it's unilateral if the international community is supporting it, but this is our stance right now. President Obama was recently in Europe. He was meeting with heads of state, and one of his goals there was to convince his European allies to vote no along with him. What happens in September, I think, will be interesting. I think a lot of the Latin American and Asian countries are going to vote yes. I think that this is going to be approved. But how many European countries Obama and Israel can win over to their side will really go a long way in determining how legitimate this new Palestinian state is. After it passes, as I believe it will, I don't think that life is going to change for the Palestinians. We still have the Israeli military occupying Palestine. But it would be a symbolic victory. It would send a message to Israel, too, that there are people who are supporting Palestinian statehood and the rights of the Palestinian people. A third example of how we are defending Israel in the international fora is we will not be attending the Durban 3 conference in September. This is an international conference designed to address problems of global racism, look at solutions and root causes of racism, and how we can begin to move away from our racist attitudes. We're boycotting, we're not attending this because it has been suggested that Zionism is a form of racism. So we will not be participating in this extremely important conversation. Another aspect of the special relationship between Israel and the United States is our tendency to build up Israel within the United States, to create a case for Israel here, create popular support for our policies in support of the Jewish state. And one of the ways that this happens is Congress passing absolutely ridiculous, meaningless resolutions that aren't designed to move policy forward, but are designed to express the sentiment of Congress. One example of this is U.S. House Resolution 260, quote, recognizing the 62nd anniversary of the independence of the State of Israel and reaffirming the unequivocal support for the alliance and friendship between the United States and Israel. I mean, there's nothing wrong with affirming our relationship, but we don't pass resolutions on every single nation's Independence Day, congratulating them and calling them friend. So this is the kind of thing that Congress does on a regular basis. They're busy. Congress has a lot of work before them, but this is something that they get derailed with on a regular basis. Every year, there is a resolution for Congress to move the U.S. Embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. Tel Aviv is the internationally recognized capital of the State of Israel. Jerusalem is where Israel would like its capital to be. Of course, Jerusalem is a very sticky subject right now because there is questions whether or not it will be a divided city between Israel and the Palestinians, or a shared city, or an international city, or exactly what's going to happen there. But again, Congress is just kind of reinforcing this friendship, the whole idea that this is a state, that we are a state that is going to support Israel through anything. So who upholds this relationship? Who is responsible for the strategic relationship between Israel and the United States? The answer is Congress. Congress blocks presidents from taking action. When Obama came into office, we saw this immediately. He started talking about what he was going to do in the Middle East. He wanted to see the establishment of a Palestinian state on the 1967 borders. He wanted to see an end to Israeli settlement construction and expansion. He spoke more forcefully than presidents have in recent years, but Congress has not allowed him to take any action against Israel. And so we have this unfortunate situation of our president standing up and saying this absolutely has to end, Israel saying no, and we look completely impotent in the region. And we're laughed at in Israel, in Israeli society as well. So this is something that has been a problem for a long time. I think the first instance of this tension between Congress and the White House was in 1975 when President Gerald Ford wanted Congress to allow him to put pressure on Israel to enter into disengagement talks with Egypt. Again, at the end of a war, Israel is in control of Egyptian territory. Ford didn't even go to Congress saying, we want to withhold money, we want to do this, this, and this, in order to make Israel do this. He just wanted to compel Israel to at least start talking to Egypt afterwards, and Congress did not approve that. They said no to him, and I think that that was the first time that we saw that happening. One of the more important times we saw that happening was in the 90s, when President Clinton was trying to enforce the Oslo Accords. The Oslo Accords, of course, are the settlement negotiated between Israel and the Palestinians, that was reached at Camp David. And as soon as Oslo was announced and put into effect, Israel immediately began violating the stipulations of the Oslo Accords, again, mainly through the expansion and construction of settlements. But Congress did not give Clinton the authority to act. The reason Congress defends Israel in this way is largely because of the Israel lobby. The Israel lobby is a coalition of lots and lots and lots of different pro-Israel organizations throughout the United States. The main one, the one that I think most of us think of when we think about the Israel lobby, is AIPAC, or the American Israel Public Action Committee. Their 2010 budget was $52 million. So they're a very, very effective lobbying organization in Washington, D.C. I would also say now that sometimes the phrases Israel lobby and Jewish lobby are used interchangeably, but that's incorrect. This is the Israel lobby. It's advocating on behalf of Israel, not on behalf of the American Jewish community. Until 1967, though, lobbying for on behalf of Israel really took place behind the scenes. AIPAC's roots are very, very humble. Part of the reason that AIPAC wanted to keep a low profile was just because of the political situation here. There was anti-Semitism in this country, and Israel itself was not necessarily, it wasn't the power that it is today. And so there wasn't a lot of support that had been built up around the state of Israel yet. It was still kind of an unknown quantity. And so they tried to stay out of the spotlight and just negotiate quietly with members of Congress and the White House. The 1967 June war changed that. Israel came out victorious against five very powerful and large Arab states. That galvanized support for Israel within the American Jewish community, but also really throughout the entire United States. It was kind of a Cinderella story, really, and Americans love that kind of thing. Israel emerged as a military power in the Middle East, and this strengthened that argument that Israel is a vital strategic ally. If we're working closely with Israel, we can use Israel to our advantage to put down policies and politics that are happening throughout the region that are not in line with our interests. The main tool of AIPAC and the Israel lobby is, of course, money. AIPAC supports friendly candidates and members of Congress who are up for re-election by contributing to their campaigns. They can also support opposition candidates to run against those candidates who do not agree with their positions, who are non-friendly members of Congress. AIPAC is also a resource for policy creation. They send out a weekly newsletter. It's called the Near East Report. It summarizes a lot of stories from around the world that pertain to Israel, to Palestine, to the Arab world. And it sets forth AIPAC's position on the issues of the day. This is something that a lot of members of Congress and their legislative assistants take advantage of because the information is just right there. It's summarized for them, it's concise, it's put together in a manner that's visually appealing. It's a good, solid resource for them, although, of course, heavily slanted in favor of Israel. AIPAC staff is also on hand to help members of Congress and their aides write speeches and draft legislation, and this is something that the overworked members of Congress and their staffs take advantage of on a regular basis. AIPAC and the Israel lobby are effective because of their ability to reward their friends and to punish their enemies. But it's able to do this because of the resources, the monetary resources and the support that it has managed to earn over the decades that it's been in power. But it also benefits from the lack of any sort of robust, viable opposition. We don't have somebody advocating on behalf of the Palestinians in the same way that Israel has somebody advocating on its behalf in Congress. And part of the reason is because the Israel lobby, as I said before, does not advocate on behalf of American Jewish people, it advocates on behalf of Israel. So its policy is set by an external power. It's set by the government of Israel. It's something that's not really open for negotiation and debate among the members. So AIPAC can always go to Congress with a consistent and unified message. Lobbying that's taking place on behalf of the Palestinians in the United States tends to be taken on by Arab Americans. Arab Americans are doing great things on the Hill, but they have a huge variety of issues that are important to them. And especially since September 11, 2001, those issues have been primarily domestic. A lot of Arab American lobbying organizations have been focusing on things like getting Arab Americans included in protection under hate crimes laws. And they have been successful just recently in passing legislation to this effect. But unifying around Palestine is something that hasn't happened. Also, in part because Arab Americans are from lots and lots of different countries. And so maybe what's happening in their own countries and what's happening in U.S. in terms of U.S. foreign policy toward those countries is more of a priority for them than Palestine. So it's a lot more diverse, and the message isn't as consistent and as clear as the one coming on behalf of Israel. Some of the results of the current U.S. Middle East policy. Well, for the Palestinians, the result has been 44 years of occupation. It's been land that's lost to settlers, to settlements, and settlement infrastructure. It's a separation wall that is now four times the length of the Berlin Wall and can reportedly be seen from space. It's checkpoints and Israeli-only roads that do not allow Palestinians free movement within their own territory. It's home demolitions, Israel's policy of demolishing homes that were built without permission from the government of Israel. And it's demonization, I think, in the United States and in the West, the idea that Palestinians are responsible for terrorist activity, and that Palestinians are the ones who are blocking peace from reaching the Holy Land, and Palestinians who keep walking away from the negotiations. So that's for the Palestinians. I think the results for the United States are arguably not much better. We have lost our credibility in the Middle East. We are not a neutral broker in this conflict, and everybody sees that. To stand up and say that we are going to be the ones to negotiate a peace between Israel and Palestine is laughable in most of the world right now, because we act as Israel's lawyer, not as an unbiased party to these negotiations. The Cold War, the argument that we needed Israel as a vital strategic ally in this Cold War against the Soviet Union has been replaced. It's been replaced by the War on Terror. Now we need Israel, our friend and ally, to work with us in stamping out terrorism in the Middle East and South Asia and around the globe. What Congress doesn't like to admit, but what Congress does understand, is that U.S. support of Israel's occupation of Palestine is the number one source of anti-American sentiment throughout the Middle East. You will often hear members of Congress saying they just hate us. They hate our Western values. They hate who we are. And that's not true at all. Polls that have been done by a variety of different organizations, some of them sponsored by Israel, the results of these polls are almost always suppressed because they never line up with what Israel is saying is the truth. These polls show over and over again that Arabs do support our values. They embrace our values, and I think that is being proven right now better than it ever has been before with all of these pro-democracy revolutions that are taking place throughout the Middle East. These same polls also show that Arabs in general love our entertainment. They love our movies and our music as well. So the idea that they are so other and they are so foreign and they just hate us is not true at all. It is our policies in Israel and Palestine that are causing this anti-American sentiment. And this comes forth not just in polling evidence, but through declarations that are made by terrorist leaders. Osama bin Laden had said over and over and over again that the main reason for orchestrating the attacks in New York on September 11th was our support of Israel against the Palestinians, and this was an attempt to free Palestine. So where do we go from here? I mean, there is so much happening in the world right now that I think is really interesting and really exciting. But when we look at our own political process and our own policies, it seems like we're not moving anywhere. Netanyahu was just here last month, and he gave a speech before Congress that resulted in more standing ovations than President Obama received from that same Congress during his State of the Union address. Netanyahu was applauded for saying things like, "We will never return to the 1967 borders." Standing ovation in Congress. So I think that the work that I was doing in D.C. was very discouraging, because this is something that is so big, it has grown to be just this enormous machine and institution in D.C., is something that's going to be really, really hard to challenge. Part of the work that we were doing in Congress was coalition building. We identified members of Congress, kind of put them into different categories as either completely pro-Israel and not worth our time and energy, or people who could be potential allies for us, people who have already spoken out against the occupation, people like Keith Ellison from Minnesota, Brian Baird from Washington State, Dennis Kucinich from Ohio, who have put forth legislation, who Baird and Ellison visited the Gaza Strip after the invasion in 2008-2009, becoming the first members of Congress to do that since, I think, the 60s. And so there are a few heroes for Palestinians in Congress. So we identified them, and then everybody else is kind of in the middle. And those are the people that we focused a lot of our attention on, because they're the ones who could potentially be won over. And what we heard over and over and over again visiting these different offices was, yes, of course I'm opposed to what we're doing here, I don't actually support this, but I'm not going to come out and be the pro-Palestine candidate. Because as soon as you begin to do that, or pro-Palestine member of Congress, as soon as you begin to do that, you're pigeonholed. That's it. Ellison is only asked questions about Palestine and about Muslims these days. And most members of Congress have their own agendas. They have, and they should, they're working on behalf of their own constituents. They want to make sure that they can advance policies that are going to be of benefit to the people that they represent. And so trying to bring people together around this issue in a way that makes them realize that there actually is support for what they're doing was one of the things that we had worked on. We had marginal success, I would say. In 2008, 2009, during the Gaza War, Kucinich put forward, it was just a dear colleague letter, just something that was going to be submitted to the president saying, you know, we don't support what Israel is doing in Gaza. Israel has overreached its boundaries here. And I think he got four people to sign on to that. 2 years later, Jim McDermott began circulating a similar letter calling for an end to the siege of the Gaza Strip. And we spent several months really working hard on this letter, and we got, I think, 43 signatures to it. So we're moving in the right direction, I guess. But what I've been thinking about lately, just this last winter and into the spring, is whether or not this really matters at this point. The revolutions that have been taking place in the Middle East have happened in spite of us, not because of us, and we have even acted to try to stop some of them. Hosni Mubarak in Egypt was one of our strongest allies. We loved Mubarak. We did not want to see him go. He's gone anyway. And I think that that type of energy that is moving through the Middle East right now is where I am turning to find hope for the future. Palestinians are now beginning to unite Palestinians within the territories, uniting with Palestinian refugees from Middle Eastern countries to come together and launch nonviolent protests and marches on Israel's border in a more unified way than has happened since the 1980s. So there are things to be excited about here, I think. That doesn't mean that there's no role for us in terms of working with Congress. I think that things are going to change. I think that the occupation of Palestine will eventually come to an end. And I think the United States Congress needs to be prepared for that. And so there's still a lot of work to do to make us more receptive to the changes that are happening on the ground. So there's work, but I think there's also hope as well. Arab American lobbying organizations are getting more and more involved in this as well, in creating an attitude in Congress that is more receptive to the transformation that's taking place in the Middle East. So I don't have, I can't see into the future. I can't make predictions. I have been shocked so many times over the last few months reading reports of what is happening in the Middle East. But I think it's exciting. I think it's something that we could legitimately put a little bit of hope in without being too completely naive, which is how I often feel when I am hopeful about Palestine. I think that's about all I have, but there's so much happening right now. This is such a relevant issue. I do want to open it up for a discussion. It's about 10 after 9 right now, so we can go for another 15 or 20 minutes or so, or as long as you're interested.
Are you getting very many of the prominent people in Congress or people that would probably have a better way of convincing their constituents? Or are you just dealing like one-on-one?
Yeah, the organization that I worked for was small. There were only five of us there, and our budget was about $100,000 as opposed to $52 million. And so the scale that we're working at is much, much smaller. But yes, we have been working to identify members of Congress who have already spoken out and who are working and encouraging them to really be proud of that and to educate their constituents on that, because you bring up a good point. Constituent support for this is an important thing. Part of the reason the Israel lobby has been able to be so effective is because it has the support of so many people in this country. And I'm not sure that numerically they're the majority. In fact, I know they're not the majority. The majority of Americans would like to see a peaceful resolution of this conflict. But the people who are supporting the lobby are very well positioned to be very influential. And they're also very, very committed to this issue. So if you see an op-ed in the New York Times that is either calling Israel out for poor behavior or defending Palestinians, you're going to see a flood of letters coming to the editors of the New York Times saying, this is anti-Semitism. And that type of fear and that type of response that the Israel lobby is able to create doesn't really have anything to do with money. It has to do with the commitment of the people who support its work.
we might want to send letters to those politicians that we substantially support.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And tell them, please quit subscribing to the
yeah,
Middle East
to the
report,
yeah,
and be prepared to, you know, shed the terrorism that we are assumed to be causing or supporting now that we're going to have this change in the Middle East.
Yes,
that
yes.
That seems
I think
like you know, a way of talking to them, you know, yeah. You better get ready because the end is near.
Yeah, yeah, no, I think that that's absolutely right. I have a sheet here that it's the same sheet that I had out on Monday, mm-hmm. if you were here for that, but it's a list of different organizations that are engaged in this, and one of the categories of organizations are those who are working for change in U.S. foreign policy toward the Middle East and Israel and Palestine. And all of these organizations, the one I worked for, AFER, also the U.S. Campaign to End the Occupation, which is probably a much better known, larger organization, they're doing a lot of work like that. And it's worth getting on their email lists if you're interested in these issues and want to take some action.
I'm sure if we send each of those organizations $50, you're going to get endless emails.
yes, you would. The APER, the organization I work for, does try to limit its emails to 1 week. Yes.
Let's assume for a moment whether we change our policy or whether the United Nations votes to have a Palestinian state. How is that going to play out in the future? Assuming that happens, how is that going to play out in terms of the relationship between the Israelis and the Palestinians and the neighbors around them, to where we have some sort of stable situation there?
Yeah, I think that initially, like I said, not a lot is going to change. I think that ending the occupation is the more important goal rather than the establishment of a Palestinian state. Because we can call this Palestine. We can say this is a Palestinian state. The military is not going to leave and things aren't going to change for the Palestinians. In terms of stability within the region, I don't know. I think that the Palestinian statehood bid has the support of most of the Arab states. I think that they will sign on to that. They would like to see the establishment of Palestine. A lot of the Arab states would like to see a lot of the Palestinian refugees leave. They've been there for a really long time. They'd like to see them be able to return to Palestine. I'm not sure what it's going to mean for Israel.
I want to be clear that I understand what you're talking about. Okay. When you say Palestine, are you talking about all of Israel as Palestine? Are you talking about the area that has been designated as the Palestinian state?
Yes. What I'm talking about when I talk about Palestine is Palestine of the 1967 borders. This is the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, and East Jerusalem. When President Obama spoke about the Middle East last month, he used the phrase 1967 line with mutually agreed land swaps. There are major settlement blocks around Jerusalem that Israel wants to keep. I think this is problematic for a number of reasons, but our policy right now is that some of those settlements could remain part of Israel in exchange for Israeli land. One of the proposals for that is making that swap land that would connect the Gaza Strip to the West Bank. So that would be a continuous Palestinian state. But Israel would still exist. Israel would still exist as a Jewish state in this scenario.
And then where do we go from there?
I don't know. I mean, that we need Israel to feel secure because it's not going to end its occupation until it does. We need a Palestinian state, a Palestinian government that is recognized by Israel and recognized by the West. That may or may not include Hamas, I don't know. They are an active part of Palestinian civil society, for better or worse. But beginning to normalize those relations, beginning to bring Palestine into the international community and giving it voice in the United Nations and in other bodies is a step in the right direction, I think. There have been plenty of other cases where new states have emerged, and we've learned how to work with these governments, we've learned how to work with these new borders and with the changing realities on the ground. This is going to be a particularly difficult situation, because the occupation has lasted for such a long time. This has been reality. There have been generations, two generations now, of Palestinians who have not known life outside of occupation. And so as they come into their own, that there are going to be bumps along the way. I don't think that this is going to be an easy process for anyone involved, but I think that it's one worth remaining committed to, and it's one that is worth investing in. Yeah, so I don't know if that's a satisfactory answer, but it's, I don't know what the future is going to look like.
You mentioned a powerful Israeli lobby in Washington, D.C., and I was wondering if you could talk a little bit to the extent of the actions of a certain, militant groups in Palestine may influence the U.S. sentiment towards Israel.
Definitely. The lobby has been able to capitalize on that. Yes, there is terrorism in the Middle East. There is Palestinian terrorism. It exists. But it's been amplified in this country to the point where if there's going to be a story about Palestine, it's probably going to be about terrorism. And so that all of that helps to kind of solidify our image of the Middle East as a hostile place for a Jewish state.
That's kind of a follow-up question. What exactly are the what exactly is the Palestinian people doing to kind of combat perhaps that negative image that maybe generate?
Mm-hmm. They're a little bit helpless in that the world doesn't really pay attention to them. They get more attention, more positive attention from European and Asian news sources than they do here in the United States. And so the stories are getting out some. But the work of the nonviolent activists, those who are organizing civil society, is a story that just isn't told. This network of nonviolent activism is so much bigger than people realize because it's something that's just kind of been hidden from us. If you read alternative news sources, though, in the United States, but also sources, mainstream sources from around the world, you'll begin to get a different image of what Palestine is really like.
It's taught in the schools, right? Nonviolent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And that's not. It's not built into the curriculum of the Palestinian Authority. It's not state policy, but the village that I live in, for example, teaches nonviolence in its elementary school. And that is something that's happening in a lot of places, and something that's kind of gaining steam. One of the more interesting articles I remember reading just a couple of years ago was an op-ed in the Times by Bono, who came forth and said, you know, where's the Palestinian Martin Luther King? Was his question. And people responded rapidly with letters to the editor saying the Palestinian Martin Luther King, the Palestinian Gandhi, the Palestinian Aung San Suu Kyi are all in prison. They have been organizing these protests against the occupation for such a long time. They are out there, they are fully committed to this, but they are in prison for what they're doing. And it's not their fault that we're not paying attention, it's our fault.
I have two comments I'd be interested in your reaction to. One is, it seems like one of the things that's happening in this country that could change the dynamics of all of this is that young people now are much more interested in and concerned about social justice than people of my generation were. And I'm on a college board, which makes me very aware of that. So that's one comment. The second one is Muslims feel persecuted in this country because, a lot of terrorism takes place in the name of Allah and killing the infidels. And it seems to me that the Muslims in this country could do themselves a real favor by speaking out against that. You know, this isn't Islam, I don't think it is. I'm no authority on it, but but they don't say anything. They're quiet. So the only thing we hear is kill the infidels in the name of Allah.
Yeah, I think on that point, there's a lot of fear, and I think that the fear is keeping peace-loving Muslims from standing up and identifying as Muslim, from standing up and making this their issue. There's a lot of desperation to just be an accepted part of the society and not to highlight the differences, not to highlight the religious identity that puts me outside of the mainstream in this country. And so I think that that's part of it. I think that there have been efforts, there have been a lot of efforts led by Islamic leaders in the United States, by different mosques, to come out and try to explain what Islam is to this country. Their voices haven't been heard to the extent that they should be, and I don't know all of the reasons behind that. But I think that it ties in a little bit to your first point, too. Right now, this is an age where we have greater access to information on what's happening around the world than anybody has ever had before. I started to learn about Palestine in 2000, and there was so much information there. I had to dig a little bit, but not really very hard. I mean, 5 minutes with Google and the internet, you can turn some of this stuff up. And so I think that is going to continue to aid the Muslims in this country in getting their message out, in connecting to people through social media, through through different alternative news sources outside of the mainstream, maybe.
Can I make a comment to that?
Sure.
Just the part of what you're saying is a while ago there was a story about a mosque that was going to be built on Ground Zero or near Ground Zero, right? And there was this big media storm about it. Well, it wasn't a mosque, it was a Muslim center that had been in that location before 9/11. And it was a moderate Muslim. But I bet you didn't hear that in the news. It was a terrorist organization that was, you know, Muslim. And so I think even when the story's there, we don't tell it. It gets told as, or it gets exaggerated as, there's going to be a mosque with terrorists near Ground Zero. So, no.
Yeah, that's great.
But even when it gets told, we don't hear it. That's the other side.
The press is suppressing the positive side, and they're bringing out very strongly the negative side.
Yes, and I think that the media has a history of doing that on a variety of issues, not just this one.
Right.
Our local mosque has an interreligious picnic once a year, and they invite university students and all kinds of churches. And it's amazing the number of Muslims that come from other parts of the region just to be there, to sit down and talk with the few that are willing to come out and talk to these people. My solution is, after there are two states, to immediately divide the foreign aid that Israel now receives in half, give half to the Palestinians, half to Israel, and not either one of them the ability to use that for weapons.
Wow. Well, good luck.
I don't know why I keep trying.
Does the United States give any foreign aid to Palestine?
Yes, it does. But that aid is controlled by Israel. Aid reaching the Palestinian Authority is controlled by Israel, and so they tend to filter it towards the Fatah party, which is the party that's in control in the West Bank. This is a legitimate political party that has denounced terror and recognized Israel's right to exist, and is the party that's negotiating with Israel. But any aid that would go to Hamas, of course, is not getting there. And well, I shouldn't have worded it that way. The United States would never send money to Hamas. Hamas is on our terrorist list, and so we're not going to be funding that. But money that would go to any sort of like unity government, which they're working on right now, a unity government between Hamas and Fatah, all of that is going to be channeled through the PA. I'm sorry, through Israel, who has final say over where it ends up. There, after the Gaza War in 2008-2009, the United States pledged millions of dollars in reconstruction materials and direct aid to Gaza. And some of that was also food aid as well. And there were reports that months after this aid was pledged and the aid actually made it to Israel, the in-kind goods were sitting in trucks on the Israeli side of the border and had not yet gotten in. All of the food aid had spoiled, and Israel just simply wasn't allowing anything to pass. So yes, there is aid to Palestine, but it's not always reaching the Palestinians.
Are there any Israeli Gandhis who are taking a look at this issue? We talk about the Palestinian ones, but
are there Israeli Gandhis?
Yeah,
definitely. The Israeli peace movement has it's not as robust as it once was. It got a lot of attention in the 80s, and then it made the strategic decision to really tie itself to the Oslo Accords. There was a lot of optimism in the 90s that this negotiation process brokered by the United States was going to lead to a lasting peace. And so the Israeli activists put all of their support behind that. And when that process collapsed, and when Palestine and Israel returned to violence, they lost a lot of credibility. They also lost a lot of hope. I think individuals really burned out. And so there has been a slow resurgence over the last few years. I think for a while, the Israeli peace movement was like centered in Tel Aviv, but they were doing a lot of activity in the West Bank. But now they're focusing a lot of their activity on Palestinian East Jerusalem, where Palestinians are being evicted from their homes on a fairly regular basis to pave the way for Israeli settlements there. So yes, they're there. Again, it's part of the story that's not being told for a variety of reasons. They're more visible in Israel than they are here in the United States. But they're out there. They're out there. There's a great film about a man named Ezra Nawi, who has been imprisoned a number of times, but he's a friend of mine, and I can't actually remember the name of the film right now, but I'll look that up for you, but it's about his life and work in the territories and in Israel to change attitudes.
You know, the problem I have with what's going on is, to me, it looks like that while these are big things that are happening, they're really secondary in terms of importance. And I say this, Israel has between 200 and 400 nuclear weapons, and they have a lot of different, not just perceived, but real, I don't want to call it, maybe not call it enemies, but groups and powers that are pushing on the elimination of them as a state. They're at, you know, you're talking 6 million people with 60 million to 100 million people around them that if they were to have a democratic vote, they would most likely overwhelmingly vote in favor of eliminating Israel as a state and the Jews can go somewhere else. That's the reality on the ground. And my question here is,
can we disagree with that reality on the ground?
You can disagree with it if you'd like. But what I'm gonna ask is, how do we, you know, it's like what we hold countries close to us because of the danger that they have in affecting not the whole world. And the fact is that if Israel had lost the first go rounds in some of the earlier wars, they would pull the nuclear weapons out and start using them. And when they use those, that's going to change the lives of everybody on Earth. Because if we have a limited nuclear exchange with Israel and its neighbors, we're going to have a nuclear winter, and we're going to lose about a third of the population of the world. Okay? So, and not just, I'm talking about the whole world. So the question really overwhelming in terms of my personal interest is, how do we avoid that scenario?
Well, how have we avoided it up to this point? I mean,
what we've been doing.
But I think that there are a lot of reasons that Arab states have not attacked Israel. I think that Israel has proven itself militarily without the nuclear weapon in successive wars. Anytime Palestinians have, or Lebanon or Syria has tried to organize and invade Israel or get into some sort of military conflict, they've lost. And Israel is the military power in the region. I think there's more stability there than maybe we realize. I think, too, that the world is defending Israel's right to exist. The world has accepted Israel as a reality, and I think that not just the United States, but a lot of other countries would come to defend Israel if it were under serious attack. I think we're seeing this with Iran. We are not the only country that is supporting sanctions against Iran. We are not the only country that is trying to prevent Iran from developing nuclear weapons. And so, yes, the nuclear threat is something to be concerned about. And it's something that I'm not as knowledgeable about as I would like to be. Frankly, I know that Obama and Secretary Clinton are engaged in some initiatives to try to decrease the number of nuclear weapons, you know, between the United States and Russia right now. Israel doesn't seem to be included in that conversation, and I don't understand why, and I think it needs to be. But yes, the nuclear threat is something that we need to be concerned about. But I think that there's enough stability in the region right now that I'm not concerned about all-out nuclear war at this point. I don't know. I mean, others can chime in. It's a little after 9:30 right now, so please, if you need to leave, feel free to take off. I'll stick around and talk with people as long as you would like to.
As a kind of a follow-up question, as my understanding, when there was one of those wars, was it 73 or 65, when Israel was actually invaded and with the support of the United States was able to overcome its enemies. I'm not a history, I'm a chemist.
Okay.
but that's what I heard through the grapevine. What element of that stability in the Middle East would you say is due to U.S. support, and what part of that would go if it was withdrawn?
Well, I'm not advocating for the withdrawal of U.S. support from Israel at all. I'm not even advocating for the withdrawal of financial support from Israel necessarily. I'm advocating for the United States to put pressure on Israel to end its occupation of Palestine. And I don't think that that changes the political and the nuclear calculus in the region. One of the arguments that it's a little bit cliche and a little bit simplistic, but friends don't let friends drive drunk. You know, Israel is not doing itself any favors. Israel is creating enemies for itself through its occupation of Palestine and through its oppression of its neighbors. And if the United States were a true ally, I think that we would do more to encourage it to end these policies and to be the state that it has claimed to be the state that it was established to be. And I think that that would go a long way towards improving the stability. I think if Israel were behaving more responsibility, that anti-Israel sentiment would diminish, maybe not go away completely. I think there will always be people who think that Israel is a delegitimate state and doesn't have the right to exist. But there are always going to be people who are going to delegitimize any power in the region. We have plenty of people who hate the United States as well. And we have nuclear weapons, but we're probably not going to discharge them very quickly.
I'm going to say it. No, I'm not a strategic expert on all these things, but in the event that a nuclear war or between Israel and its neighbors would happen, I'm not sure if it would be enough to begin a nuclear winter unless the whole world got involved. Is that what you're implying with that, many nuclear weapons?
What I'm implying is two steps. One is that the first step is that we have a limited nuclear exchange that causes an economic collapse in the world. And at that point, the rest of the world says, this is enough of this. We're going to settle this thing. We're going to come in with a military force to occupy this place and make sure that this doesn't happen again. We're not going to let the world go through a collapse. And before that happens, Israel will fight and they'll die. They'll die. I've been there. I know. They'll die. The country will die as a country.
My point was just
and if they do that, we're going to have a nuclear exchange.
I was just not sure that that exchange would bring on a nuclear winter. That was my only point. My second question I have for you, you pose a possibility, as I'm thinking, you said something about a good solution would be to not have a separate state, but one state. Did you say something like that, where if that were a solution, where there'd be representative government for Palestinians and Israel? What would that look like?
I'm not putting that forth as a solution. That is a solution that has been proposed by some.
Why couldn't it work?
We're talking about the division between the one-state solution and the two-state solution. The two-state solution is standing U.S. policy that there should be a free and independent Palestine standing alongside a safe and secure Israel, two separate states for two separate people. Within Palestine, especially, also some voices within Israel, there is a call for one bi-national state. What this means for Israel is it's no longer a Jewish state, and Israel would never stand for that. I don't think Israel would ever stand for that. So I think that that almost ends the discussion before it begins. If we could get past that, if we can imagine some way to get past that, what would a binational state actually look like? Well, I don't know. Right now there are, and I don't know the exact numbers, but there are millions of Arabs, ethnic Palestinians living inside Israel. They live as second-class citizens inside Israel. And if that were to be expanded to the territories, that's not something that I would encourage happening. I don't know. But the Jewish Israelis would be the minority there too, so maybe that would change things. But I don't know. That it's something that's being proposed. There are a number of people who are really defending it. A man named Ali Abundima is someone who has written extensively on this, and he's somebody to take a look at. He's an interesting character.
When you say, you know, the walls they've built.
Yeah.
I mean, so they have their own state. It's not going to solve the problem of being able to not get to work. So. On the other hand, the walls have cut down on suicide bombings, mm-hmm. it seems, you know,
yeah.
but poor guys can get to work,
right.
People, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems like that would make, how much is, you know, a few billion a year worth to them if we leveraged that and said, well, we'll support this and maybe even more, but you guys got to get along.
Yeah.
And maybe that's agreeable.
Yeah, would Israel keep doing what it's doing without support of the United States? I'm not sure it could keep doing
what it's doing.
Just to add to what you've already said, when you've given us so much information that's useful, right outside, are you aware of the bulletin board? People probably aren't in here. That
mm-hmm.
shows a visual of the map of Israel and Palestine, the occupation, and the green in 1947 shows Palestinian land, and you need to see what it looks like now. It's a very good visual to add to what you're saying.
Yes, there are some resources on a bulletin board out here that have to do with what the ELCA, the Lutheran Church, is doing in Palestine. A few campaigns. They have a campaign called Peace Not Walls, and that is their primary initiative to bring some justice to this land.
Do you think it's possible that some of these, some of our support for, monetary support for Israel, I should say, may change just because of the budget realities that are going on in Washington now? I mean, I think that are there outside forces that may force?
Possibly, but I feel like it hasn't happened yet. And I feel like if that were to happen, it probably would have happened by now. I'm not sure how bad things would have to get before we began to cut aid to Israel. It's a possibility, but I don't know for sure.
Do other countries give Israel aid?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are a lot of other countries give Israel aid. A lot of other countries condition their aid to Israel, and nobody is giving aid in the amounts that we are giving.
Israel gives aid to other countries. I was in Nicaragua this year, and
absolutely.
they get aid from Israel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. A lot of places. Chris?
You know, one of the things that always strikes me about these sorts of discussions is that we go through the laundry list of topics, you know, everything from the history to terrorism to foreign aid, military aid, Israel's relationship with its neighbors, et cetera, et cetera. And they're all legitimate topics and they're all worthy of discussion, certainly. But I'm always struck by this sort of, and I don't think it's glaring because I don't think a lot of people think about it anyway, the subject of natural resources, that Israel is essentially a desert country with no natural resources of its own, trying to maintain essentially a first world lifestyle and everything that goes along with that. So although I have no doubt that its primary motivation as a state over the years has involved any number of those topics that we spent a great deal of time discussing, at a certain point, the existential threat to Israel is not nuclear Armageddon, but a simple lack of natural resources, especially water, full stop. And so I think a lot of what gets overlooked in the nature of the discussions of politics, culture, prejudice, everything that goes along with that, is simple physical need of those resources to maintain the lifestyle to which they are accustomed. And the same can be said for all of us. I don't think we have that discussion, period. But it's an especially acute case for the state of Israel. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, you're right. I think that's something that has the potential to, well, is going to impact everyone around the globe at some point in time. Most of Israel's water comes from reservoirs that are in the West Bank, but that Israel controls at this point. And I don't, there are a lot of environmental organizations that are working in this region. And I'm not super familiar with their work, and I don't know what their predictions are for